Chapter 2. The entire floor of my hotel had been secured so fast, my neighbors must all have been in shock. So far as they would ever know, someone had made an attempt on my life, and I'd shot him in self-defense. They'd see the body bag being removed, but they'd never suspect what sort of thing was actually inside it. I wondered how they'd have reacted if they had known.
"I wish you hadn't killed it,"
Cole said, his voice manifesting itself in my mind. "Well, now, what the hell was I supposed to do?" I said out loud, still feeling badly rattled. The men sealing the body bag glanced at me. They hadn't heard Cole's, of course, and they looked puzzled for a moment. Then they figured out what was going on and wordlessly went back to their task.
"I didn't mean that as a criticism,"
said Cole's.
"I was merely expressing regret that we missed an opportunity to capture one of them alive. It obviously intended to kill you and take your place. If it had succeeded and we weren't monitoring you, your death would not have been registered before the creature could assimilate your biochip and it might have penetrated our security. We were very lucky. It was a close call."
"Yes, I'm so relieved that we came out of it all right," I said.
"I want you both to report in immediately,"
Cole said.
"I don't want either of you talking to the news media, so I'm having you picked up in the lobby. Not a word to anyone. Understood?"
Understood. I watched the men carry the sealed body bag out into the hall. "Doesn't seem to bother them," I said. "Think they'd bagged human-headed serpents every day." Breck glanced at me.
"Are you all right?"
"Yeah, I'll live. I'll probably have nightmares for a while, but these days, what's the difference? Awake or asleep, reality or hallucination, seems like it's all the same damn thing."
"You mean it isn't?"
Breck said, grinning and flexing his nigh steel fingers. He had lost his real arm in the service, and the prosthesis had some interesting modifications built into it, such as the knife blades that sprang like stilettos out of his artificial fingers. Not to mention that the nigh steel alloy itself was damn near indestructible. One shot with it was all it had taken to pulverize my door.
"You, ruined my door with that damn thing," I said.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to knock quite so hard,"
I grimaced ruefully.
"I guess I should stop complaining about the scan crews monitoring us our own time. For all the damn good it did, if I hadn't shot that creature, their monitoring my readouts would have helped me much. You would have arrived too late. No one saved my ass this time but me."
Breck raised his eyebrows.
"Are you quite certain of that?"
I glanced at him sharply.
"What do you mean?"
"Chem control scanners registered abnormal levels in your readouts, resulting in signal alarms that alerted them to tune you in. I suspect that confronted with the spectacle of Cassandra Daniels in her scundies, or what you thought was Cassandra Daniels, you reacted with predictable excitement. And the fact that you had been drinking, which affects the biosignals, and the result was an abnormal readout of some sort. The real Miss Daniels, still on duty back at game control, thought it prudent to tune you in and check on your activities. Imagine how surprised she must have been when she tuned in and saw that you were about to make love to her. The Hambermorph apparently plucked your current fantasy straight out of your mind the moment you walked in. However, the significant thing about all this is that the creature didn't pick up on the fact that you were being monitored, either because it couldn't or because it was too intent on plucking a familiar and compelling image from your mind to throw you immediately off guard. It suggests that the Amphimorphs are not infallible mind readers, and that's encouraging news."
I was slow on the uptake.
"Well, wait a minute. If Cassandra tuned me in and saw what was happening, why didn't she contact me?"
Breck looked amused.
"What makes you think she didn't?"
I suddenly remembered that nagging little feeling at the back of my mind, that insistent prodding sensation which had burst into a powerful attack of paranoia, and I realized what must have happened.
"She knew you were in trouble," said Breck. and distracted by a rather powerful sexual stimulus. Rather than throw you off balance by using voice contact, which might well have caused a fatal hesitation on your part, she simply activated your strongest defense response and amplified it. You did all the rest. I think it was an excellent judgment call on her part. She saved your life.
I stared at him, stunned. I'd been wondering why Coles bothered with someone like me when he could easily have recruited more hybrids like Breck with superior strength, responses, and powers of concentration. The answer, of course, was that someone like Breck would be a lot harder to manipulate. Breck was wired differently. Coles could not tiptoe through his mind without Breck knowing it. The degree of mental discipline and control that came so easily to Breck was excruciating work for me. I was getting better at it, but Breck, being a hybrid, would always have the edge. Consequently, Breck was a good choice as an operative, but a poor choice as a subject for experimentation to see how much cybertech could do applied to ordinary humans as behavior modification. I began to see that I was much more than a covert government agent playing Psychodrome professionally as a cover. I was an experimental prototype as well. When Coles learned where all my buttons were and how to push them, he could do the same thing more easily with others, and in such a manner that they would never be aware of it. It was as if I were the vehicle, and Coles and his people were sitting behind the wheel, learning how to drive.
I see.
I said softly, trying not to think about the worst nightmares of George Orwell.
I suppose I'm going to have to thank Cass Daniels for pushing the right button.
Breck gave me a wry smile.
Just make certain that it's really hard this time.
There had been some changes at the corporate headquarters of Psychodrome International since Coles and his people took over. They were subtle changes for the most part, such as the security system that relied not only on hidden scanners, but on human receptionists and guards plugged into the security matrix, their senses monitored by security control. To the casual observer, the lobby of the building looked no different than it had before the advent of what some of us referred to as the change in management. Personally, I wasn't all that convinced that there had been a change in management. I had a sneaking suspicion that Coles might have been running things all along. I know. Paranoia. Entering through the front doors from the courtyard plaza, you came into the cavernous atrium. The centerpiece was the massive multiplex holocube display. The huge cubes were clustered like quartz crystals, each containing constantly changing scenes, slices of experience from past interactive game scenarios. The whole thing was suspended over a reflecting pool, which, depending on the time of day, was either placid or had colored fountains playing in it. Beyond this garish testament to our corporate image, there was the information desk, staffed by a covey of bright, young, helpful people whose primary function was to be polite, cheerful, and attractive, without being terribly accommodating. If you were able to convince them that you had legitimate business somewhere in the vast corporate hive, they would point you in the right direction, usually down one of the side corridors leading to a bank of lift tubes. However, by the time you'd gotten that far, you'd already been scanned about a dozen different ways, examined by both automated and human sensors. While that charming young receptionist was soothing you with her seductive voice and perhaps even flirting with you a little, she was making direct eye contact and her visual impression was being instantaneously transmitted via her biochip to security control, where computer enhancement of the image enabled a reading of your retinal pattern for identification. Your voice print was checked as the receptionist listened to you speak, and the scanners hidden in her desk made certain you weren't carrying anything antisocial on your person. More of the same took place inside the lift tubes, which were equipped with concealed anti-personnel weapons, capable of tracking and zeroing in on individual passengers and rendering them either unconscious or dead without harming the person standing next to them. If necessary, though, the entire tube could be destroyed. Needless to say, all but a handful of employees were ignorant of these procedures, just as only a handful of employees knew that there was something more to Psychodrome than entertainment. In other words, we were so paranoid, we didn't even tell our own people what we were doing. As far as I knew, Coles never left the upper levels of the building.
Perhaps he felt safer there, or maybe he wanted to be right on top of things 24 hours a day. Probably both. The maximum security floors of the building were prohibited to anyone who wasn't implanted with a biochip. Everyone with clearance for access to those floors was now monitored by automated scanner banks around the clock. At the first abnormal reading, as had happened in my case, alarms went off, and a scanning engineer on duty tuned in immediately. Coles was serious. I wondered if he was serious enough to have had himself implanted with a biochip as well. I guess he probably had. Fanatics like Coles tended to be true believers in the system. If it were up to him, he would probably have a biochip implanted in every infant that was born. He was waiting for us in his office on the top floor. It was all done in black. Black carpeting, black walls, black ceiling, black furniture, black fixtures and accessories. It was like the inside of a womb. I always felt slightly disoriented in this office, a little claustrophobic, as if I were visiting a mole in its lair. "Come in, gentlemen," Coles said from behind his big black desk. "Have a seat. I'd like you to see something." He pressed a tiny sensor panel in the console, set flush with the desktop, and a panel in the wall slid up to reveal a hollow screen. "The footage you're about to see," said Coles, "was obtained from an independent producer who was attempting to sell it to the news media. Fortunately for us, they didn't bite. They thought he was trying to pull a Hustle with some special effects." The scene flashed on abruptly, showing a beautiful young woman standing on the guardrail of a spanway against the background of the Midtown Towers, high above the lower levels of the city. She was clearly about to jump. Breck and I both tensed as we recognized Stone Winters, only we both knew that this wasn't really Stone. It was the Ambimorph that had returned to Earth with us by assuming her identity. What we were watching on the screen had taken place moments after the creature, still in the shape of Stone Winters, had escaped from the very building we were in. Game Control had still been receiving signals from the biochip the Shape Changer had assimilated when it had eaten Stone, and I knew what was coming up next. The creature had panicked at the sight of all the vehicles bearing down upon it as it fled out onto the spanway, and it had leapt over the guardrail, shape-changing as it fell. We were on its trail when it happened. Game Control had been receiving signals from the biochip, and Coles had fled the transmission directly to Breck and me. I recalled the terrifying sensation of falling, followed by the quick feeling of winged flight, the transformation taking place so quickly that there was no sensation whatsoever of the change. What we had experienced through the medium of the biochip interface with the creature, we were now about to see for the first time. "This was an absolute fluke," said Coles as he froze the image on the screen. "This guy was shooting a series of background scenes for an ad agency campaign, and he just happened to catch this." He started the footage once again, reversing it so that it rewound to the scene an instant before the cameraman had seen Stone up on the spanway. "All right, now here's where he spotted what he thought was a woman about to commit suicide." He resumed running it once more, and we saw the blurring effect as the cameraman quickly panned up to the spanway, catching the woman poised on the guardrail. A second later, she jumped. "Now hold on to your seats," said Coles. The camera followed us as she fell, tumbling like a high diver out of control. And then suddenly, incredibly, the falling figure exploded, bursting apart into a flock of small birds, pinwheeling around one another, and then grouping together into a flight that went soaring out of frame as the picture tilted crazily. "Here's where he dropped the camera," said Coles, stopping the holographic footage and then reversing it. He ran it from the fall and froze the image at the instant of the transformation. The process had been too fast even for a holo camera to capture. One moment, a falling woman. The next, a human figure exploding into birds. "My God," I whispered.
"Amazing," said Breck, staring at the screen. "So that was how it seemed to achieve the impossible and alter its mass. It never altered its mass at all. It simply rearranged it by separating into discrete entities linked by one intelligence. I never dreamed that they could do that."
"But what about the people who saw this?" I said. "What about the cameramen? How did you intend to keep them quiet?" Coles shrugged.
"I have no intention of trying to keep them quiet. They can talk about it all they please. They're even welcome to talk about how we seized their footage. The news media have already decided it's a psychodrome publicity stunt.
But what if nobody believes them?
People believe all sorts of irrational things, said Coles. They see ghosts, they speak with Jesus Christ, they wrestle with the devil, they're kidnapped by little green men in flying saucers, aliens walking around us is hardly something new. I doubt even the sensational press would find it very interesting. On the other hand, our xenobiologists find this utterly fascinating. The fact that the Ambimorphs can do this seems to support the theory that they reproduce asexually, by fission.
You mean mitosis?
Breck said. Coles shook his head. I don't know. I'm wary of sticking a convenient label on it until we know for sure exactly what it is they do and how they do it. It could be a form of cell division we've never even seen before. Our people believe it's possible that what we're dealing with here is not a species of individual creatures, but that each ambimorph is a sort of colony. As you said, Breck, discrete entities linked by a common intelligence, but also linked apparently by something more than that, something like a common nervous system, possibly based on enzymes or even something on a particle level, micromolecular. A dead ambimorph becomes fixed, rather like water freezing into a solid block of ice. The cells, I guess you call them, aren't completely independent. They can sustain a certain amount of damage. But past some point, trauma becomes irreversible. We know that they can be killed. What we didn't know is that we could be dealing with interdependent, symbiotic communities of creatures that behave together in an individual manner.
You mean like a hive?
I said. Coles raised his eyebrows. Perhaps. It's an interesting way of putting it. Of course, we won't know any of this for certain until we can manage to get our hands on a live ambimorph. Which brings me to the main reason why I sent for you. Have either of you ever heard of a place called Purgatory? Purgatory. Just the mention of the name was enough to make my stomach start contracting. I'd once spent 3 months on Purgatory while I was a supply sergeant on a service freighter, and those 3 months had been three of the most miserable months I'd ever spent anywhere, including the Ginza Strip, Junktown, and that bug-infested swamp of a planet where I received my baptism of fire as a psycho, fighting with a brigade of corporate mercenaries. I'd heard of a place called Purgatory, all right. I was 20 years old, and the barge we charitably referred to as a ship had limped into a port at Purgatory Station, where our chief engineer finally conceded that it would take more than a crescent wrench and some electrician's tape to effect repairs. What it took was an overhaul of the drive system, which tied up engineering for about 3 weeks, and debugging a small glitch somewhere in the navigational computer, which only took a little over 2 months. Those of us who were not in engineering or systems maintenance had nothing to do except Mickey Mouse makeup work, and we'd already been doing that for months. So the skipper decided to break down and give us some shore leave on the planet's surface. 5 of us never made it back. We never did find out what happened to them. They had been drinking. There wasn't much else to do on Purgatory. And they had taken a jet-powered desert sled out beyond the confines of the military ground base. They had been careening around the desert, shooting up the bleeding cactus, when they ran out of fuel. A search party from the ground base made several flyovers, and they finally located their desert sled. But there was no sign of our men. No one seemed surprised. Their bodies were never recovered, possibly because there were no bodies to recover. They might have encountered one of several predatory species who lived out in the high desert plains. They might have died of exposure and been recycled by the efficient little scavengers of Purgatory, who wasted nothing, not even the bones. Or they might have been taken by the natives, nomadic tribes whose life in the high country was so harsh that they could always use an extra hand or two. Having found the abandoned sled and no sign of our men within a 50-mile radius, the ground base commander had simply shrugged and said, "Forget it." Our skipper gave us a choice. Go back up to the orbital station and our ship, or remain confined to the ground base. The ground base commander didn't much care what we did. As far as he was concerned, if we were stupid enough to go out into the desert and get lost,
That was our own lookout. He had other things to worry about, such as the fact that it looked as if he was never going to get his transfer. So he did a lot of drinking. I wound up doing a great deal of it with him, watching my crewmates one by one succumb to the endless heat and drudgery and take the shuttle back up to the ship, rather than go bugfuck. I was determined to make the most out of my groundside liberty as long as we were there, because I knew that it would be a long time before I got on my feet on solid ground again. But a choice between staying aboard ship or ground liberty on purgatory was like a choice between a killer migraine or an infection of the urinary tract. I couldn't imagine why in God's name Coles would send us to a place like purgatory. There was nothing there, except for a few refineries and a toxic waste dump or two. However, as I learned from Coles, it seemed that purgatory had experienced some growth in recent years, and the high pay scales and harsh conditions had made it a natural recruiting ground for the Draconis Combine. After a few years spent on purgatory, workers had more than enough cash to stake themselves to a crystal hunter's gamble in the Combine's Fire Islands inhabitants, and they were desperate for a thrill. All too many of them wound up getting more thrills than they had bargained for. The Combine operated frequent flights between Purgatory and the Fire Islands. The Draconis Combine was not above selling contracts, a polite euphemism for indentured servitude. There was always a need for laborers on Purgatory, and the Combine liked to maintain a decent turnover in the habitats. It was all too easy to get suckered in by dreams of easy money and adventure in the Fire Islands. Once you got there, you might decide that a crystal hunter's life was far too violent for you, and then you wanted out. That was when you fell prey to the human sharks who inhabited the island. If you were lucky, you got out on a turnaround. If you weren't, you found out what slavery was all about. If you were lucky, you were turned around and had your contract sold, most likely to one of the companies on Purgatory. It was a vicious cycle that trapped a lot of people. There was virtually no escape. Once the value of your contract and the freight had been worked off, you were then free to go anywhere you liked. However, first it would be necessary to save up for the fare, and meanwhile, you had to eat, so you signed another contract. It was a profitable system for the Combine for many years, but the Fire Islands' habitats were under quarantine now. Ambimorphs who had broken the quarantine would have been more likely to wind up on Purgatory than any place else. From there, given enough money, they could have gone almost anywhere. However, it seemed that some of them had stayed. There had been an explosion at one of the refineries. A huge cracking tower had been demolished, and the fire had damaged much of the plant before it was brought under control. It had been no accident. Explosive charges had been strategically placed, and just before the tower had blown, a plant foreman had ordered everyone away from the site. They later found him, bound and gagged in the storage closet. He swore that he had been struck from behind, and that he had come to inside the closet, where he had been unsuccessfully struggling to escape his bonds for hours. And despite eyewitnesses' testimony that he was the one who had warned everyone out of the area, the foreman denied having done any such thing, insisting that someone was trying to frame him. It looked like it was time to play another game. The player master Coles had assigned to run the operation was our old friend Tolliver Mondego. Coles had far too many irons in the fire to personally run field agents on a mission. Mondego would make sure that Coles was kept informed. Personally, I didn't know who was worse, Coles or Mondego. Mondego had a lot to answer for. The crazy old man had almost killed us last time. I often worried about telling the difference between reality and programmed hallucination, but I wasn't sure Mondego knew there was a difference. And Coles would only part with so much information. As usual, the operative term was need to know. Personally, I needed to know a lot more than I was being told. I didn't know if Coles was playing it by ear or just close to the vest. Probably both. I don't know if Mondego knew more than he was willing to tell us, or if he too was being made to function purely on a need-to-know basis. Again, probably both. For that matter, I didn't even know if this was going to be a real mission or merely another elaborate hallucinact the home audience would share with me. It was a hell of a way to train agents and run a covert operation with live coverage on mass media entertainment channels. The audience would be sitting at home, plugged into their sci-fi sets, vicariously participating in what they thought was an interactive fantasy adventure game. Only it would be for real. Appropriately edited, of course. And as they plugged in and watched and heard and smelled and felt, Coles would be undoubtedly plugging in to them at the same time, feeding them subliminal programs and prepping them for future use as they enjoyed their entertainment. He'd be learning how to push their buttons. It was the new ecology. Eat or be eaten. Beat or be beaten. Use or be useless. I came out of downtime as the ship made its approach to Purgatory Station. The last thing I remembered was sitting in a comfortable black leather chair in Cole's black, dimly lit office. Someone flicked a switch and turned me off, and now I was coming out of it trillions of miles away. There were no viewports in the supercargo compartments Breck and I were traveling in. Tiny individual passenger cubicles, not much larger than the inside of a coffin. But I was able to see Purgatory Station by turning on the small monitor screen built into the bulkhead. There wasn't enough room in the compartment to sit up, so I turned over on my side and popped my head up on my elbow, watching the tiny screen as we made our docking approach. There wasn't much to see. Purgatory Station was a small island habitat, a sphere about 1 mile in diameter with external radiators at its poles that removed heat from the interior of the station, and solar mirrors that directed sunlight inside the windows near the rotational axis. Like most stations, it was equipped with a tachyon drive. It functioned as a starship until it reached its destination, and then it became a permanent orbital habitat. If necessary, it could become a starship once again, but leaving orbit would mean leaving behind the various smaller workstations and cylinders that had been constructed around it over time and linked to it with skyhooks. There were a lot more of them than when I had been here as a young non-com in the Supply Corps, berthed aboard a freighter we used to call the slop bucket. Our pilot then wasn't much better than our pilot now. Docking was accomplished with all the dexterity of a drunk trying to thread a needle. But we eventually made it and locked on. We left the ship and transferred to a shuttle that would take us to the planet's surface. The cargo would follow later in several shifts, and anyone who had brought a lot of luggage would have a long wait until they could collect it at the ground-based spaceport terminal. Fortunately, Breck and I were traveling light. As we made our descent to Purgatory, I saw that nothing had really changed. It was still a wild, desolate world of low mountains and high plains, which leveled off toward the equator into vast deserts that seemed to go on forever. There were a couple of oceans on Purgatory, much smaller than those on Earth, and there were a few lakes nestled in mountain valleys. Someday, there would probably be cities, but for the present, there was nothing here except for a number of sprawling refineries and industrial plants that were the sole reason for human presence on the planet. You could make a flyover of the barren plains and see miles upon miles of nothing, and then suddenly you'd see giant islands of metal rising up out of the ground like surreal sculptures surmounted by dense clouds of pollution, the unmistakable footprints of man. Having almost poisoned out our own world beyond recovery, we were now dumping our waste into other people's yards. There had been a lot of construction since I had spent 3 lonely, maddening months here all those years ago. Small developments had grown up around the plants, scattering of clustered workers' housing all looking absolutely identical, interconnected by plastic tubeways. The shuttle landed and we disembarked. I was immediately struck by a blast of desert heat and the stench of pollution. Breck sniffed the air and grimaced.
"Travel halfway across the universe," he said, "when you arrive at a place that smells just like New Jersey."
We hurried across the tarmac and into the air-conditioned coolness of the terminal. We were supposed to meet a man named Grover Higgins. I imagine some corporate type stamped out here with a cookie cutter, glib and superficial, a PR man with red eyes and ruptured capillaries in his nose from too much drinking. Someone who had suffered a long fall from the climb up the corporate ladder and was struck out in the middle of nowhere, desperate to make good and get out. Grover Higgins turned out to be not at all what I expected. The man who greeted us as we came into the terminal was in his late 40s, about 5'10 and well-built, 180 pounds, with thick, dark brown hair and sleepy, deeply set brown eyes. He was darkly tanned and his hair was streaked from sun bleaching. His skin had the weathered look of a man who had spent a great deal of time outdoors. He had a slow and easy dimpled smile and a relaxed, informal way about him. He was dressed in lightweight khakis and well-worn leather boots.
"Mr. Breck, Mr. O'Toole, I'm Grover Higgins,"
His hands were calloused, and his handshake was very firm. The hands of a real working man, not an office button pusher.
"Hope the flight out wasn't too bad,"
he said.
"That all you brought with you?"
"Yeah, just a hand luggage,"
Breck said.
"I find it's always best to travel light myself,"
he said.
"How about a bite to eat and a drink? Or two? Or three?"
"Sounds fine to me," I said. He led us to a little cart and beckoned us in.
"Hop aboard."
He sat behind the tiller and the cart whispered off quickly across the terminal, heading toward a tubeway. The tinted plastic cut out the sun's glare, and the cool air inside the tube was a marked contrast to the heat outside. The tube ran from the terminal toward the plant, with several branching off points along the way, where the tube corridors radiated out from traffic circles like spokes from a wheel. Other open carts zipped by us, but we didn't see a single pedestrian. Apparently, the people in Purgatory didn't walk any more than they had to, and they spent most of their time insulated from the outside environment, which made me even more curious about Higgins with his outdoorsy look. He didn't seem to fit in.
"We'll be eating out at my place, if it's all right with you,"
he said.
"Not that we don't have any bars or restaurants, but I think I can promise you better food than that. I'm a pretty decent cook."
"Hope you won't go to any trouble on our account, Mr. Higgins," said Breck.
"It's no trouble. I like to cook, and I thought you might prefer a quiet place to eat and talk a bit. Our bars tend to be a little on the rowdy side, and you being celebrities, I thought you might not want to attract a crowd right off."
"That's very thoughtful of you," Breck said.
"Like I said, no trouble at all."
The cart swung around and shot off down another branch of the tubeway, heading toward a cluster of residential buildings nestled in a slight depression. He parked the cart at the end of the tubeway, and we went into the village. It was designed as a residence mall, with all the individual dwellings clustered together into one huge multi-leveled structure. The entire village was sealed off from the outside. The climate control systems kept the temperature inside quite cool, as if in overcompensation against the heat outside. The corridor opened out onto large, wide, multi-leveled walkways with tinted lights overhead. The interior of the mall was generously landscaped and heavily planted with trees, vines, flowers, and shrubs, sweet-smelling herbs and mosses, rock gardens, and artificial streams and waterfalls.
"Looks like a damn rainforest, doesn't it?"
said Higgins.
"It's like living in a terrarium. I try not to spend a lot of time here."
As I wondered where he spent most of his time, he led us up to a door and opened it by placing his palm against the sensor pad. As we entered, he called out to someone in a language I'd never heard before. The woman who came out to greet us was dressed in a knee-length khaki skirt, a plain white cotton blouse, and knee-high soft leather boots. Her hair was thick and dark, almost like a horse's mane, naturally streaked with gray and silver highlights. Her skin was the color of coffee, and a lot of cream in it, a light caramel shade, and her eyes were golden. She moved with a sinuous grace that made me think of a large, predatory cat, a mountain lion.
"This is my wife, Tyla,"
Higgins said.
"She's tribal."
Which meant, of course, that she wasn't human. End of chapter.